The advice and recommendations in this program are for general education purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional before beginning or changing any course of health treatment.
This is House Calls with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email housecall@cfra.com or text us at 580-580. Now, here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good morning and welcome to edition number 921 of House Calls for this April the 7th, 2024. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. We're broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. And we'll be taking your calls shortly, and we're trying. We have some technical difficulties. We have a guest, Dr. Christopher Labos, who is the author of Does Coffee Cause Cancer? And Eight More Myths About the Food We Eat. And if Dr. Labos is listening in and we can't seem to get the Zoom thing working, you can call us at 521-8255, 613-521-8255 to try to call in on the phone lines. And we're going to get into a conversation with him. He is a cardiologist with a degree in epidemiology. He spends most of his time, I love his bio, he spends most of his time doing things that he doesn't get paid for, like doing research, teaching, and podcasting. And occasionally he finds time to practice as a cardiologist so he can pay his rent. He realizes that half of his research findings will be disproved in 5 years, and he just doesn't know which half. He's a freelance contributor for the Montreal Gazette, CJAD, and also appeared on CBC Radio and CBC Television. And to date, no one has recognized him on the street. So we're going to get into this. This book is, I finished reading his book, and it's really well done. It's more of a conversation within the, and we have him here. Chris, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, good. It always happens, you know, you depend on something to work and it just doesn't work.
It's, you know what, the number of times technology has failed me when I'm giving a presentation or something, it's really frustrating. You really sort of wonder who has the upper hand here, us or the machine sometimes.
That's right. Well, as I was mentioning, I loved your book. And okay. I have one question for you.
Yeah.
What happened to Jim, Katie, and Casey?
Ah, well, listen, if I can get a sequel off the ground.
Oh, it's just fantastic.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, you write a book about science, and most of the questions I get from people is actually about the narrative, which I thought initially was just going to be sort of this cute little thing to sort of drive the story forward. And yet people do seem to like the whole narrative of it because you have these storylines. And the first note I got back from the editor when I first submitted the manuscript was like, I wasn't expecting there to be character arcs in a science book, and yet there are. So
It was brilliant, I have to tell you, because it became conversational, you know. Yeah. And I don't know. I read in the book. I don't know if this is true in real life for you, but I don't get invited to very many parties either.
Yeah. Well, and it's tough because it sort of happens to me because you're at somewhere and somebody says something and you have this moment where like, do I try to correct them and give them good scientific information or do I just go with the flow?
Yeah.
Because you hear all kinds of things, right?
I know. And you can't resist it. I can't help myself.
I know. I can't help myself sometimes either. And it becomes very frustrating. So, yeah, a lot of me got poured into the book. Somewhat unintentionally, because again, I had set out to write a very straightforward science book, and somehow this romantic comedy sort of came out of it. So there you go.
But it makes it much more, you know, because when I was reading each of the chapters, and I bought both the Kindle version and the audiobook, and the audiobook was really well narrated. I really like that. It's the conversation, right? It's easier because of the story context, as opposed to just providing the hard facts about the questions that are being asked. And in fact, the food even becomes secondary because I found this to be more of a review of how to think about problems as opposed to just dealing with the food itself and that being the only topic of conversation, but rather what goes into the particular studies that are done, what are the flaws, why we should be very skeptical about certain studies. You know, my general animus towards food studies and observational data that drives me crazy as people derive conclusions from it. So I found that was very helpful because otherwise I think people can get overwhelmed by all the different concepts that are being presented in the book.
Right, and I think that's the point because if you wrote it as a pure didactic thing, like here's what you need to know, people will walk away from it being like, okay, coffee is fine, moving on. But when you sort of explain to people what selection bias is, even if, you know, they're not epidemiologists, they're not going to know these terms, you start to understand, it's like, okay, how we design studies matter, and I think that sort of gives people a little bit of a defense against, you know, these repetitive news headlines. I mean, I just did something the other week about this group in the U.S. trying to get rid of methylene chloride from decaf coffee because they're afraid it can cause cancer.
Right.
And so if you read the book, I mean, one of the main through lines of the coffee chapter was the whole thing about acrylamide in coffee and how it had to have warning labels in California, but it never did. And so you realize that a lot of these same issues keep coming back, and it becomes to a certain degree very repetitive. So once you understand the underpinnings of all of this, the subject matter is irrelevant because the mechanics of what's going on are the same, and you become much better at identifying. You're like, oh, yeah, we're worried about an ingredient. Well, we don't have to worry about an ingredient. We know coffee doesn't cause cancer. We studied it, you know, six ways from Sunday.
So now you have a podcast. It's called The Body of Evidence with Jonathan Jarry, who's been on my show too. And Jonathan actually writes great stuff on the McGill Office for Science and Societies, as you do as well. One of the things I find is that it takes a long time to rebut a spurious accusation or a falsehood, right? The fear, uncertainty, and doubt that is fomented on social media and in even the mainstream media. Someone can make a claim, and you have to spend hours to be able to rebut that, to show the science behind things. Is that an aspect, at least I find for myself, it can be a very difficult aspect to deal with because you get exhausted trying to put out all the fires because it's not just a simple matter of saying, well, no, it isn't. You got to explain why it isn't.
Right. And I wrote a sample sequel chapter, so I'll give you a sneak preview
for
your listeners. If there is a sequel, one of the chapters is going to be about aspartame and artificial sweeteners.
Right.
And, you know, they've been in the news recently, but there's a whole history to them. And so to do the subject matter justice, you really have to go back to the original approval of aspartame and address some of the issues that came up of, you know, conflicts of interest and it was approved too quickly. And that takes an inordinate amount of time because you have to go back, you have to read, you know, the original FDA decision, which could be, you know, over 100 pages. Like, there's a lot of effort that goes into it. And so it's very hard to do these types of debates, like you said, because, you know, it's very easy to say something like, I'm worried that artificial sweeteners cause cancer. You know, you say that, people get scared. To write a 2,000-word article about this, or to put together a video or to write a book chapter requires so much work that by the time you do it, people have already moved on to something else. And it becomes very hard to be reactive, right? If you're trying to be reactive to what's out there, you're always going to be behind the eight ball. you almost have to be a little bit proactive. And that's why when you have sort of the mechanics of how these studies work, you can be with somebody like, ah, but that was just an animal study. And be like, oh, okay, I remember you talked about this before, about the problems of, you know, translating animal studies into humans.
Yeah, you don't want to be like Jim in the book where you mention his eyes glaze over when you start talking numbers.
Well, that was also a very useful narrative device for me because, again, if you're going to write a book like this, you have to be true to the science, you have to be true to the math, but you can't make it too technical because people are going to zone out.
They're going to absolutely zone out. Yeah. Absolutely zone out.
But when you have these characters, they can now make jokes about it, like skip over the math, and then you can put it in the appendices or in the references. So it became a very useful way to sort of jump over some of the boring parts while still giving people the references if they want to go and check out the math. So it was a very useful narrative device to sort of keep the narrative going.
Well, it keeps it very real. You're dealing with people now instead of just numbers and facts and figures. So it becomes relatable to a lot of people that are reading it.
Yeah. And here's the thing, too. Again, you know, I love epidemiology. That's what I did my master's degree in. I think this stuff is fascinating. And, you know, especially if you're doing it in a written form, it becomes, you do have a little bit more license than you would have, like, on the radio. Because, you know, on the radio, you're not going to be able to start, like, rattling off statistics. But at least in the book, it gives me the freedom, like, you can do tables, you can do graphs, you can sort of explain complex stuff in a way, but also still grounded in a person's actual thing. And so the characters also are able to ask the question the audience would ask, to be like, okay, yeah, fancy numbers, fancy numbers. What does that mean for me? If I eat bacon, will I get cancer? And then you can have the narrator respond in a practical way to be like, well, it's really going to boost your lifetime risk from, let's say, 5 to 6%.
Yeah.
Now it's up to you to decide if that's a big enough risk that you're going to change your eating habits.
Exactly. Yeah. I want to take a small break. And we're going to come back. I have a lot of questions. I want to deal with things like gish galloping and sea lioning and how you handle those situations and also get more into the book, a lot of other questions. So we're going to take a small break. We're in conversation with Dr. Christopher Labos, cardiologist and epidemiologist, also part of the McGill Office of Science and Society. That's a website that I've mentioned many times on the air on the show. Fantastic site dealing with evidence-based medicine. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Welcome back. We're in conversation with Dr. Christopher Labos. He is a cardiologist and epidemiologist in Montreal. I'm from Montreal as well. Went to McGill. I'm sure you is at McGill as well. Also part of the McGill Office for Science and Society. And talking about his book, Does Coffee Cause Cancer? And 8 More Myths About the Food We Eat. And as we were talking about, Chris, it's not necessarily about the foods themselves, but it's the manner of thinking about the process that leads to the comments you're making in the book.
Yeah, it really is because, I mean, I wanted to write a book about epidemiology and statistics, but of course, no one would buy a book.
No, I would not have bought that book.
No one would. I mean, that would become a textbook for students. It wouldn't be for the general public. And so you make it about food because that's something that people care about, something that everybody has to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And then you make it essentially a romantic comedy to keep people entertained, which was not the original plan. The original plan was to make it a very almost like, you know, Socrates and Plato, where you have these two characters talking, but they're sort of personality-less.
Yeah.
And so the original version that I wrote was the doctor talking to a barista in a coffee shop.
Yeah.
And I showed it to a friend of mine, and I said, what do you think? And she was like, pretty good, but I kept expecting him to ask her out at the end.
Yes, and he should have. Jeez, what was the matter with you?
He should have. And the minute she said that, though, I could understand how this book could also be a romantic comedy and that you could also deal with, you know, like you have a bit of a story arc there. So it became, there's multiple levels to this book. You can enjoy it as, I think, a fairly, you know, lighthearted comedy, but you can also go to it to learn about why the headlines, especially headlines about food, why food news headlines are so often wrong and so often contradictory.
So let's get into that, right? Because there is a tactic that people use, especially, I don't know if you get into debates with pseudoscience purveyors. I mean, we're told not to do that because you just end up in a situation where they're doing things like gish galloping, right? Throwing questions at you one after another. Well, what about this or what about this? And as we talked about earlier, it can take a while to explain the reasoning why what the claim being presented is wrong, but they're just firing stuff at you to make it seem like you don't know the answers to things because it's too quick to be able to respond. And that is a favorite tactic of that type of environment. And have you had to deal with that?
Well, so it's absolutely a problem. And I think we have to sort of almost, you know, take a page from military tactics. It's like, you know, if you're going to fight a war, if you're going to fight a battle, choose your battlefield, right?
Right.
So you have to realize a lot of the social media platforms are not well suited to scientific debate. You know, so Twitter, for all its, you know, potential, or I guess X now, right? For all its virtues in terms of connecting people, is not really well suited to scientific debate because things just get lost. And I don't find it a very useful thing. So I don't spend that much time on Twitter.
Right.
And that's the thing, is like, you don't have to rise to every challenge that is pointed up to you. I mean, if we were still living in the Renaissance and somebody threw down a glove and said, I challenge you to a duel, you don't have to accept. And I think that's also the point, is that we don't, especially when you have your own venues for scientific communication, like you have the radio show, I write my article for the Montreal Gazette, you have a way to communicate science to people, and you won't necessarily reach everybody. And I think you sort of just have to come to terms with that. And I think that's the point, is that you don't have to do everything. You have to pick and choose the venues where you can do the most good. And those venues are things like what we're doing right now, having, you know, a long-form conversation where we can get into nuance, where we can be like, yeah, not everything's perfect, but it's still pretty good for X, Y, Z reason.
I agree with you. The only issue is that these platforms reach a lot of people. And and part of it, too, does sometimes ventures into influencing policy because there's so much pressure from groups that it grows and it grows, and sometimes if it's unimpeded, it may lead to harm to other people. You know, we saw that during COVID. We see that in the vaccination issue, where if information goes unchallenged, if false claims go unchallenged, and you're right, you know, you can't be everywhere all the time, but it does have this tendency to cause harm, and that's what gets to me the most, is that there are people being harmed by false information.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And I think the solution is this, is that we have to produce, I don't think it's debating these people on these platforms.
Sure.
I don't think that goes anywhere. But I think we do have to produce content for these platforms. And that's where, you know, the youngins are particularly useful. Because, I mean, I have Facebook, I have Twitter, I have, you know, I have an Instagram account that I barely use. I use it mainly to look at dog photos. There is a way to use this stuff effectively. And I know that I'm not the best person to do that, right? I know I am just old enough that social media kind of just passed me by.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's why what we need is a team approach of many people across the country of many different ages to do this sort of stuff. And I wish there was a network. I wish there was, you know, like the Avengers, where we could all come together to do stuff. And there isn't really a type of thing like that. Like, it is shocking to me that we essentially live 2 hours away from each other, which is not that far, and we've actually never met. We've never had a conversation before.
Yeah.
And you know, as I was planning the auto event for the book, I was like, because I kind of knew your show. I listened to the show. I go, you know what? I should just reach out to him.
Yeah.
I was able to speak to one of the producers at CFR. And he said, do you have his email? And he passed it along to me. I emailed you. I was like, we should do these types of collaborations to
Absolutely.
Help. Because none of us can do it alone, but we don't have, you know, it's not like, it's unfortunately not like the Olympics where we can pick out, you know, all the best hockey players from across Canada to put together a dream team, because there is no framework for it. And I wish I had an answer to that, but maybe we need to build something like that so we can do TV, radio, print, and the social media when we try to promote good science information.
Well, I think we should do links, right, where we have every so often, you know, we each go on each other's shows or do something where, you know, you get that conversation going. You know, I for example, I use a lot of the stuff that's written on the McGill Office of Science and Society, and have done your articles and talked about this on the air with our listeners. So there is that. I mean, I've used a lot of your stuff, but yeah, we've never talked. Right?
Yeah.
So it would be good to have that, because it also humanizes things as well. Because if you're just seeing someone writing stuff all the time and they're being technical in some places, and their personalities may come out a little bit in the conversation, in the writing, but it's not the same as having a person-to-person conversation. People relate to stories. People relate to the personalities of the people talking. And that can move things forward in some ways, just as the book moves the science forward more than just talking about the science on a piece of paper.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think that's the one thing that pseudoscience does very well, the engaging storytelling, and that really resonates with people, right? Because you can show people a 10,000-person study about how the HPV vaccine prevents cervical cancer and how we could potentially eliminate cervical cancer. I mean, I don't remember this story from like a few weeks ago.
Yeah, the Scottish study.
Yeah, the Scottish study. You know, the idea that we could eliminate cervical cancer, that you can, and somebody asked me for the radio here in Montreal, is like, but does that mean, are you worried that women won't go for pap smears? Like, well, the potential is that you wouldn't even need a pap smear if we got to that point. And the radio host was just blown away. They're like, oh my God, imagine that type of sea change. And so, you know, you can talk to people about this study, but until you can put it in human terms, in a story, like, imagine this future where you no longer have to go for a regular pap smear. Now people understand what we're talking about. And it's that aspect of storytelling that doesn't always lend itself to scientific research, but it's something we have to start doing, because it is a very powerful tool that the other side, if you will, uses very, very effectively. We need to start getting better at it.
No, you're absolutely correct. You know, and in fact, I'm telling my patients now that, you know, this may be the last pap smear you may need to have, because now we're switching, because BC is doing this. They're using the swab to look for HPV.
So
you can do things at home just like you do colon cancer screening now. And I'm going, you know, this is how technology is changing. And so when you have the HPV vaccine, your risk is now really low. You do the swab every 2 or 3 years. And it's a screening evaluation. And if it comes back positive, then a pap test is done, or then further evaluation is done. But it makes it much more likely that most women now will have access to screening as opposed to falling through the cracks.
Yeah, and I mean, the innovation in science technology that we've seen, that I think we've both seen just by, you know, taking care of patients, a lot can be done at home. Patients measure their blood pressure at home. I have a lot of patients that have gotten a little like cardia device. They can measure their arrhythmias if they have AFib at home. I find it pretty useful. The Apple Watch, you know, same sort of technology. But so much of this can be done at home. It's very interesting that people used to go to the doctor to get tests, right?
Yeah.
So they're like, listen to my heart. The reality is, so much of my practice now is not so much about direct action, but it's about interpreting results and collating things together. And it's different, because it does mean that the practice of medicine, especially outpatient medicine, if you're doing, you know, the direct patient care, has really changed from a focus on your practical skills to your ability to synthesize data. And that's going to be the real challenge of medical education going forward, is like, can we get better at synthesizing data? Because patients are going to be doing so much of this stuff at home.
Absolutely.
And a lot of this is going to be about organization. Okay, have you gotten this? Have you gotten that? How do we interpret this result? You know, can we explain to patients the issues of false positives and why we need confirmatory screening tests, even though their first test was positive? I had a patient, I mean, this is not cardiology, but, you know, went to donate blood and got a letter from AMA Quebec, which is, you know, the Canadian Blood Services from Quebec, and it says, like, you know, your initial screen for HIV was positive, but the second confirmatory test was negative, so don't worry. But of course, they're
going to worry.
And so I had to explain to them, and I had to get out a piece of paper and explain, you know, this is how sequential testing works, yeah. and this is why the first test is more sensitive but less specific. All these sort of interesting epidemiology concepts that you sort of have to explain to people, which probably would not have been part of medical practice 50 years
exactly.
ago, and yet now are so much of what we have to do.
Well, we're going to take a small break. Are you still good for more?
I'm still good for more.
Okay, good. So we're going to take a small break in discussion with Dr. Christopher Labos, author of the book, Does Coffee Cause Cancer? And 8 More Myths About the Food We Eat. We haven't gotten to the food yet. We will. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Actually, House Calls. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
The advice and recommendations in this program are for general education purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional before beginning or changing any course of health treatment.
Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin and House Calls on News Talk 580 CFRA. Reach the doctor right now at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or text him at 580-580.
Welcome back. We're in conversation with Dr. Christopher Labos. He's a cardiologist and epidemiologist at McGill University, co-partner with Johnson Jarry on The Body of Evidence, a podcast that I listen to. Very entertaining, good banter, and author of Does Coffee Cause Cancer? And 8 More Myths About the Food We Eat. And Chris, just before we get to that, on our message board, Judy and Alman says, if I had a party, I would definitely invite both of you.
That is so sweet.
So getting to the food, right? Because a lot of the stuff with food studies, whenever I see a food study and I see we did a food questionnaire that asked the person one time what they were eating and did they remember what they ate 6 months ago, and then we extrapolated that to correlate to the outcomes that we looked at with regards to heart disease or kidney disease or you name it, Alzheimer's, whatever it is, that we found an association. But in the discussion part of the study, if you read it, it goes, there are limitations and we can't conclusively say that there's any causative effect, and yet it ends up in the headlines as it was a cause.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, food research is particularly problematic for one very big reason. We rely on food questionnaires. Like, we rely on people to tell us what they ate. And first of all, you're relying on people to be honest, which is a problem because there is something called social desirability bias where people will give you the answer they think you want to hear. So people will always upestimate how much they exercise, how many fruits and vegetables they eat. They will downplay how much junk food they eat. Not because they're being inherently dishonest. It's because, you know, people fudge the truth. This is human nature. And so it's really fascinating because when you speak to people and you ask them, how do you think this research was done? It's like, wow, you must have taken two groups of people and you gave half of them chocolate and half of them not. And I think people don't realize how much of food research is not like that. Because look, admittedly, it's very, very hard to do randomized trials in food research because just the logistics of it, it's hard to do randomized trials in general. So much of the food research has to be understood in the context of we are relying on evidence that is a little bit uncertain. And so we have to make the best estimated guess that we can. And you know, this becomes very relevant in the coffee on in the chapter about red meat, because within a few months of each other, you had two different groups reviewing the same evidence, one saying red meat is bad for you, let's declare it a carcinogen, and the other group saying eat as much red meat as you want, there's no evidence that it's harmful. And they basically reviewed the same data, and it becomes a question of how much do you want to rely on observational research or not. And this is very subjective, right? Some people who have become, you know, what's the term that we use? They sometimes fall into the concept of methodolatry, which is like, if it's not a randomized trial, I won't even look at it, which is, I think, going a bit too far.
Right, very dogmatic.
It's very dogmatic, right? So you're like, okay, listen, yeah, fine, we don't have randomized trials on red meat, because think about it, how would you do that? You would take a group of people and force them to eat bacon every day for a year? Like, that's not going to work,
no.
Right? There's no practical way to make that happen. So we have to rely on observational evidence, and we have to make a judgment call. It's like, are we confident enough that red meat is increasing the risk of cancer? And the answer, if you want me to spoil that chapter for everybody, is I think we can be reasonably certain that it does, especially when you're talking about processed red meat. So not the steak you're barbecuing on your barbecue, but, you know, the cold cuts, the bacon, the salami, the stuff that's being processed. If you were to eat it every day, that increases your risk of colon cancer a little bit. And you have to interpret that in the context, like, well, we do pretty well at colorectal cancer screening in this country, right? So is that enough of a risk to make you worry, to make you want to change your diet? That's a very subjective thing, and I think most people don't realize that science is, to a large degree, often very subjective, and that it's very rare that you have a definitive yes, no, black or white answer as to how to proceed.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the benefits and the curse of science, is that people like certainty. They want an absolute answer, and science doesn't do that. It's a methodological evaluation of the world we live in, and gives us pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that are put together over time, where we have a good idea of what the picture is, but they can change, you know, and I find that absolutely fascinating. I love when things change, Chris. I like to think, oh, you know, we thought this was true, but now that isn't, but we've learned something new, and that's what makes things so fascinating.
Well, and it is. I mean, and you should be worried. Like, if your doctor is practicing the same medicine that he did 20, 30 years ago, that's a problem, because things are going to change, right? I mean, just to throw an example out there, think about treatment of obesity.
Yeah.
Up until 5 years ago, any claim to weight loss drug was just invariably pseudoscience. And even some of the prescription medications that have been approved by the FDA and Health Canada were really not that effective, right? So they were rarely prescribed. I mean, you know, things like the cholesterol blocker from the intestine, I'm completely blanking on the name now, but like things that were prescribable were really had very little weight loss associated with them and had a lot of side effects, rarely used. And then semaglutide, Ozempic or Wegovy, depending on how you want it, comes on the market, and now you have this complete sea change. I mean, you know, probably the biggest change in our conception of something since the introduction of statins, and we went from an era where cholesterol medications were basically ineffective to suddenly having something that's incredibly effective. And so you have to be ready for these types of sea changes. And, you know, Ozempic is an interesting one, because I think it bears the distinction as being one of the few medications that is both over and under prescribed to individuals. There's many people who probably should be on it that can't get it because it's not covered by many, you know, by OHIP or RAMQ. And yet there's a lot of people, because of social media, are getting it through illicit means, which is just absolutely ludicrous. So you have to be ready for this type of thing and realize that change is going to come, and that we have to change with it. And, you know, we need to start thinking of obesity as a medical disease that we can treat in the appropriate patient population, which is, I think, the subtlety that sometimes gets lost when you're doing medicine on TikTok.
Yeah, it's interesting, because about 4 years ago, I interviewed Dr. Sean Wharton, who was part of a co-author of the Obesity Management, Weight and Obesity Management Guidelines that was published in the CMAJ. And we were talking about these medications, and also Dr. Yoni Friedhoff, who is a bariatric medicine specialist in Ottawa. I was cycling with them about 4 years ago, and you know, you can know everything about food, so to speak. You can know what you should be doing, not be doing. As a physician, I know what I should be doing, and yet I love to eat.
Yeah,
and so I was about 30 pounds over. This is with cycling and karate and everything, 30 pounds over. And I'm saying to Yoni, as a cycling, saying, you know, should I go on? Should I try Ozempic? And he said, absolutely, you should do that. I lost 32 pounds.
Yeah.
And my dad's history is when he died of renal failure, secondary to type 2 diabetes. I'm going, I don't want to go down that line. So, and yet he lived to 86. He was a smoker. He had all kinds of stuff happen to him. He lived to 86 and going, well, I'm going to live to 150 if I do things correctly.
Well, and this is the thing. I mean, it is very much a sea change in the same way. Again, I'll just come back to the idea of statins, right? You know, and I have this whole presentation about the history of cholesterol and how really things changed in the 1990s. And we went from this generalized uncertainty about whether it was even worth it to measure cholesterol to be like, oh, now we suddenly have a thing that can treat it. I mean, obesity is very much the same. We became complacent and accepting of obesity as like, oh, well, what are we going to do? It's something that happens as you get older. We can't do anything about it. Well, now we can. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do lifestyle changes, that we shouldn't do prevention, that we shouldn't, you know, deal with the issue of obesity in children and the fact that there's a lot of junk food in schools and all that sort of stuff for sure. But when you have a patient in front of you that has this medical problem, you should treat it because you wouldn't let it go if they had epilepsy or diabetes or something else, right?
Or you heart disease or lung disease or asthma or any chronic condition.
Yeah, and I think our perception that obesity was, you know, a lifestyle thing that was quote-unquote your fault was largely grew out of the fact that we really couldn't do anything about it. And so we became complacent about a disease that we couldn't actually treat. But now that we can treat it, our mindset has to change.
Absolutely.
And I think we're still in the transition phase where a lot of people are saying a lot of nonsense.
Yeah, the fat shaming and the blaming and you're weak and you can't do this on your own. It's right. Okay, sure. Actually, we got to take another break and then we'll come back again. And we still have to get to some more foods. There's a couple of things I wanted to talk about with the foods and then also what we're doing next Saturday.
Yes.
So, I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin in conversation with Dr. Christopher Labos. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Back to the last segment of the show. Boy, time goes fast, Chris. Holy cow. So before we run out of time, I think we should say this coming Saturday, April 13th at the Rideau Center, you're going to be at Indigo Books.
Yes.
And that we're getting together around 1 p.m. to just chew the fat, so to speak.
I mean,
talking about how bad it is for us.
Well, listen, here's the thing. If your listeners enjoyed what we've been doing over the past hour, show up, it's probably going to be very close to that again.
Yeah.
So we'll have this free-ranging conversation, and we'll take questions from the audience, and we'll talk about food and science, and we can talk about the Canadian healthcare system, too. We'll see where the conversations take us.
Don't get me started about that. We won't stop. So that's next Saturday at the Rideau Center, Indigo Books, April the 13th at 1 p.m. Dr. Christopher Labos is going to be there. I've been invited to join him. He was gracious enough to ask me to come by. And we'll be talking about all things science and food studies and all the stuff, as he mentioned, and answering all your questions. I want to ask you about, are there situations where you just say, I'm throwing in the towel? Like, I can't get through to somebody, or I just find that this type of topic is going to not get me anywhere?
Yeah, there certainly are. I mean, you know, if you get an email that's a thousand words long written in all caps, I'm not sure that's going to be and I've gotten those, trust me. I mean, right. You know, and you get all kinds of abuse on social media. There's one person on Twitter that no matter what I do or what I say, will comment with a study about ivermectin. I mean, just cannot let that go. And I just mute these people. I mean, I've gotten to the point where I can't really. Other people, God bless them. There are some people out there that will have these long Twitter debates and will keep like, but show me the evidence. But this wasn't a randomized controlled trial. And I, you know, more power to them. I do not know how they have the patience. So there's always a time and there's always a point where you say to yourself, this is no longer a worthy investment of my time because I have other things that I need to be doing. And so when somebody asks a good faith question, I will take the time to answer. And I have a policy that if somebody asks me a question, I will try to answer it. But the way you can usually tell if it's a genuine question or somebody who's trying to like bait you into something is the question very specific. And sometimes I get questions that be like, you know, are statins useful in people over the age of 70? Because I've heard that, you know, they've never been studied in elderly people. Now you can be like, well, actually they have, right? Yeah. And you can answer that question directly. So I think the specificity of the question is usually a good indication of whether it's a useful investment in time, because while there are certainly people out there who are, you know, anti-science, who are buying into conspiracy theories, I think a lot of people are just genuinely confused.
Sure.
And, you know, the idea of, well, go speak to your doctor is all well and good until you get into a situation where most people don't have a family doctor anymore, which is a conversation for another day.
Right. Well, and that's what your book gets into, too, because the people, the characters in the book are portraying the difficulties that the public has in general, and I include myself, of trying to discern fact from fiction, the questions that need to be asked when presented with information, the fact that it's rapid fire. We have a news cycle that is always changing stories all the time, that it's hard to keep up. And so if it's hard for people who are involved in disseminating information and providing medical information and scientific information, it's hard for us to keep up. The general public doesn't have a chance in that regard. And so the messages that come out become more and more difficult to combat in some cases.
Yeah, and here's the thing. I think we sort of expect all physicians to be sort of the repository of all scientific knowledge, and that's just unreasonable, right? Not everybody can be an expert on everything. And to be fair, you know, a lot of physicians have not been trained in, you know, critical analysis. I mean, that is a skill. Knowing how to analyze data, to crunch numbers, to read a study critically, I mean, that's a skill set that you have to be taught. No one is born with this inherent knowledge. So, you know, a lot of physicians are consumers of media, and I have physician friends who are, you know, clinical people and who are like, hey, Chris, I saw this headline on Medscape or whatnot. Is this true? And you sort of have to explain it to them because they don't have they see the headline. They don't have the time to go and read a 1,000-word article, or they'll hear a news headline about, you know, IARC declaring aspartame to be a possible carcinogen.
Right.
Well, what does possible carcinogen mean? If you read the book, you find out. But then there's this whole thing about, you know, the certainty of evidence. And you're like, well, or the intermittent fasting thing that came out of the AHA conference a couple of weeks ago, which is like, sure, but, you know, based on two single 24-hour food questionnaires.
Exactly.
And, you know, you have to put all this context in it. But again, if you're just sitting there consuming news headlines, which is what a lot of us do, you're not going to know this stuff. And so you almost need dedicated people to sort of sift through the evidence and provide thoughtful, reasoned, considered commentary.
So if you were to, and I don't know if you've thought about this, but if you were to create a simple approach for the general public or even clinicians to use when presented with a story, is there something, have you thought about, you know, what recommendations you would give to some people to start that ball rolling on evaluating the information that's coming into them? Because it's a huge area, right? I mean, you took a whole book to be able to explain some of those aspects, but I can't remember all the points you made in that book. But there's a lot of great points, all the different biases and things. You can't keep all that information in your head. So is there some sort of guide or things, something that someone could even have with them when they're presented with information that they can use to guide them along the way?
I think it's very hard to sort of do this comprehensively, but there's a few simple things you can do to at least weed out sort of the more ridiculous stuff. So was this actually published in a scientific journal and not just a conference presentation or an abstract or uploaded to a preprint service, right? So was it actually published and peer-reviewed? Not that that's a complete defense against nonsense, but at least it's better. Was it done in humans, not in animals? Was it a randomized trial rather than observational research? If you can keep track of those three things, you will at least weed out a lot of the less, you know, reliable stuff. And I think that's the first point. And again, I realize it's not practical for most people to go out and do a master's degree in epidemiology like I did, right? I would love it if that was the reality of the world. It's not. But at least if you do those three basic things, you'll realize that a lot of what people are talking about was, you know, a mouse study, or was this observational research, or was presented at a conference and hasn't been peer reviewed. So you're like, okay, well, I'm not going to waste brain power on that. Get back to me when there's an actual published paper.
I think also if people are interested, and a lot of people are, I mean, I know there's a lot of people listen to this show. I know there's a lot of people that read your articles in the Montreal Gazette and listen to your podcast and go to the McGill Office of Science and Society. I look at it as an ongoing course where if someone is interested and they're listening and reading each week, it builds up their body of knowledge so that it eventually becomes more automatic to be able to discern, you know, the wheat from the chaff in order to know what they're reading is really reliable or whether it's just, you know, there for clickbait. So it definitely is a process, and hopefully these kind of conversations and the books that are being written are going to help people along that way.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because it is a skill, and the more you practice it, the better you get at it. And we have some listeners to the podcast, like, you know, our regular listeners who correspond with us regularly. Yeah. Sometimes they'll send us something, hey, what do you think about this? Here's my interpretation, like X, Y, Z, this was, you know, an animal saying, you're like, yeah, that's a pretty accurate assessment. I think you did pretty well on that. So you do get better at identifying this stuff. I mean, and that's the thing. It's like, if you do something regularly, you will get better at it. And if you read good science, you eventually get much better at identifying the bad science, because even on an instinctive level, you look at it and be like, oh, this feels a little bit shaky. Maybe I don't exactly know why, but I feel like this is a little bit off. And that's at least the first defense mechanism to be able to recognize that, maybe I shouldn't reshare this on social media.
So this is part one of our conversation. We're going to continue this next Saturday live at the Rideau Center, Indigo Books, April the 13th at 1 p.m. I've been in conversation with Dr. Christopher Lavos, author of Does Coffee Cause Cancer and 8 More Myths About the Food We Eat. I highly recommend you read this book. And no, I have no financial interest in the book at all, but Chris certainly does, and let's help him out. Chris, it's an absolute pleasure. I'm really looking forward to meeting you next Saturday.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to meeting you too. I think it's going to be a fun time.
It's going to be a really fun time. That about wraps up our show. My thanks to Dr. Lavos for coming on and spending the hour. And again, we'll be there next Saturday at the Rideau Center, Indigo Books, April 13th at 1 p.m. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Thanks to Eric Fox for producing Sunday House Call. We'll be back next week with another edition. Everyone have a great week. From a young age, taking my soak into the masses, writing my poems for the few that look at me, took to me, shook at me, feeling me, singing from heartache, from the pain, taking my message from the veins, speaking my lesson.